course, of slaves. But he's sending the slaves to Lundeen to sell them there. They need some baby eels, eh? That'll fatten them up. The elvers were swarming into the Savan Sea and slithering up the shallow waterways of the swamp, where they were being netted in abundance. There was no hunger in Æthelingaeg. Not if you gorged on elvers.
"I caught 3 basketfuls yesterday,"
Peleg said happily.
"And a frog. It had a face just like Brother Asser, so I gave it a blessing and threw it back. Don't just stir the eggs, girl, beat them."
"I hear your son died." "Yes," I answered stiffly.
"I am sorry," he said with genuine feeling.
"I am truly sorry, for to lose a child is a desperate hard thing. I sometimes think God must like children. He takes so many to him. I believe there's a garden in heaven, a green garden where children play all the time. He's got 2 sons of mine up there. And I tell you, the youngest must be making the angels scream. He'd be pulling the girl's hair and beating up the other boys like they were goose eggs."
"You lost 2 sons."
"But I kept 3 others and 4 daughters. Why do you think I'm never home, eh?" He grinned at me. "Noisy little things they are, children. And such appetites. Oh, sweet Jesus, they'd eat a horse a day if they could. There are some folk who say priests shouldn't marry, and there are times I think they're right. Do you have any bread, dearest?"
Isolde pointed to a net hanging from the roof.
"Cut them all off," she told me.
"I like to see a man obeying a woman," Father Peleg said as I fetched the loaf.
"Why's that?"
I asked. "Because it means I'm not alone in the sorry world. Good God, but that Aelswith was weaned on gall juice, wasn't she? Got a tongue in her like a starving weasel. Poor Alfred.
He's happy enough.
Good God, man, that's the last thing he is. Some folk catch God like a disease, and he's one of them. He's like a cow after winter, he is."
"He is?"
"You know, when the late spring grass comes in, all green and new and rich, and you put the poor cow out to eat, and she blows up like a bladder. She's nothing but shit and wind, and then she gets the staggers and drops down dead if you don't take her off the grass for a while. Well, that's Alfred. He's got too much of the good green grass of God, and now he's sick on it. But he's a good man. A good man. Too thin he is, but good. A living saint, no less. Ah, good girl. Let's eat."
He scooped some of the eggs with his fingers, then passed the pot to me.
"Oh, thank God! It's Easter next week," he said with his mouth full, so that scraps of egg lodged in his huge beard. "And then we can eat meat again. I'm wasting away without meat. You know, Isolde will be baptized at Easter."
"She told me," I said shortly.
"And you don't approve? Just think of it as a good wash, then maybe you won't mind so much."
I was not in Æthelingaeg for Isolde's baptism, nor did I wish to be, for I knew Easter with Alfred would be nothing but prayers and psalms and priests and sermons. Instead, I took Stiapa and 50 men up into the hills, going towards Sippenham, for Alfred had ordered that the Danes were to be harried mercilessly in the next few weeks. He decided to assemble the Fyrd of Wessex close to Ascension Day, which was just 6 weeks away, and those were the weeks in which Guthrum would be hoping to revive his hungry horses on the spring grass, and so we rode to ambush Danish forage parties. Kill 1 forage party, and the next must be protected by 100 extra horsemen, and that wearies the horses even more, and so requires still more forage. It worked for a while, but then Guthrum began sending his foragers north into Mercia, where they were not opposed. It was a time of waiting. There were 2 smiths in Æthelingaeg now, and though neither had all the equipment they wanted, and though fuel for their furnaces was scarce, they were making good spear points. One of my jobs was to take men to cut ash poles for the spear shafts. Alfred was writing letters, trying to discover how many men the shires could bring to battle, and he sent priests to Francia to persuade the thanes who had fled there to return. More spies came from Sippenham, confirming that Svein had joined Guthrum, and that Guthrum was strengthening his horses and raising men from the Danish parts of England. He was ordering his West Saxon allies, like Wulfhere, to arm their men, and warning his garrisons in Wintoncester, Reddingham, and Bartham that they must be ready to abandon their ramparts and march to his aid. Guthrum had his own spies, and must have known Alfred was planning to assemble an army, and I dare say he welcomed that news, for such an army would be Alfred's last hope, and, should Guthrum destroy the feared, Wessex would fall, never to rise again. Ethelingaeg seethed with rumour. Guthrum, it was said, had 5,000 men. Ships had come from Denmark, and a new army of Norsemen had sailed from Ireland. The Britons were marching. The feared of Mercia was on Guthrum's side, and it was said the Danes had set up a great camp at Krakelad on the River Thames, where thousands of Mercian troops, both Danish and Saxon, were assembling. The rumours of Guthrum's strength crossed the sea, and Wilfrith of Hamptonshire wrote from Francia begging Alfred to flee Wessex. "Take ship to this coast," he wrote, "and save your family." Leofric rarely rode on patrols with us, but stayed in Ethelingaeg, for he had been named commander of the king's bodyguard. He was proud of that, as he should have been, for he had been peasant-born, and he could neither read nor write, and Alfred usually insisted that his commanders were literate. Ian Flaid's influence was behind the appointment, for she had become a confidant of Aelswyth. Alfred's wife went nowhere without Ian Flaid, even in church. The one-time whore sat just behind Aelswyth, and when Alfred held court, Ian Flaid was always there.
"The Queen doesn't like you,"
Ian Flaid told me one rare day when I found her alone. "She's not a queen," I said. "Wessex doesn't have queens."
"She should be a queen,"
she said resentfully.
"It would be right and proper."
She was carrying a heap of plants, and I noticed her forearms were a pale green.
"Dying,"
she explained brusquely, and I followed her to where a great cauldron was bubbling on a fire. She threw in the plants and began stirring the mess in the pot.
"We're making green linen," she said.
"Green linen?"
"Alfred must have a banner," she said indignantly. "He can't fight without a banner."
The women were making two banners. One was the great green dragon flag of Wessex, while the other bore the cross of Christianity.
"Your results working on the cross,"
Ian Flaid told me. "I know."
"You should have been at her baptism."
"I was killing Danes."
"But I'm glad she's baptized. Come to her senses, she has."
In truth, I thought, Isolde had been battered into Christianity. For weeks she had endured the rancour of Alfred's churchmen, had been accused of witchcraft and of being the devil's instrument, and it had worn her down. Then came Hild with her gentler Christianity, and Peerlig, who spoke of God in Isolde's tongue, and Isolde had been persuaded. That meant I was the only pagan left in the swamp, and Ian Flaid glanced pointedly at my hammer amulet. She said nothing of it, instead asking me whether I truly believed we could defeat the Danes. "Yes," I said confidently, though of course I did not know.
"How many men will Guthrum have?"
I knew the questions were not Ian Flaid's, but Aelswyth's. Alfred's wife wanted to know if her husband had any chance of survival, or whether they should take the ship we had captured from Svein and sail to Francia. "Guthrum will lead 4,000 men," I said. "At least."
"At least?"
"It depends how many come from Mercia," I said. Then thought for a heartbeat. "But I expect 4,000.
"And Wessex?"
"The same," I said. I was lying. With enormous luck, we could assemble 3,000. But I doubted it. 2,000? Not likely, but possible. My real fear was that Alfred would raise his banner and no one would come, or that only a few hundred men would arrive. We could lead 300 from Æthelingaeg, but what could 300 do against Guthrum's great army? Alfred also worried about numbers, and he sent me to Hamptonshire to discover how much of the Shire was occupied by the Danes. I found them well entrenched in the north, but the south of the Shire was free of them, and in Hampton, where Alfred's fleet was based, the warships were still drawn up on the beach. Bergweird, the fleet's commander, had over 100 men in the town, all that was left of his crews, and he had them manning the palisade. He claimed he could not leave Hampton for fear that the Danes would attack and capture the ships, but I had Alfred's scrap of parchment with his dragon seal on it, and I used it to order him to keep 30 men to protect the ships and bring the rest to Alfred. "When?" he asked gloomily. "When you're summoned," I said. "But it will be soon. And you're to raise the local feared, too. Bring them." "And if the Danes come here?" he asked. "If they come by sea?" "Then we lose the fleet," I said. "And we build another." His fear was real enough. Danish ships were off the south coast again. For the moment, rather than attempt an invasion, they were being Vikings. They landed, raided, raped, burned, stole, and went to sea again. But they were numerous enough for Alfred to worry that a whole army might land somewhere on the coast and march against him. We were harassed by that fear, and by the knowledge that we were few, and the enemy numerous, and that the enemy's horses were fattening on the new grass. "Ascension Day," Alfred announced on the day I returned from Hampton. That was the day we should be ready in Æthelingaeg, and on the Sunday after, which was the Feast of St. Monica, we would gather the feared. If there was a feared. Reports said the Danes were readying to march, and it was plain they would launch their attacks south towards Wintoncester, the town that was the capital of Wessex, and to protect it, to bar Guthrum's road south, the feared would gather at Egbert's Stone. I'd never heard of the place, but Leofric assured me it was an important spot, the place where King Egbert, Alfred's grandfather, had given judgments. "There isn't one stone," he said, "but three."
"Three?"
"Two big pillars and another boulder on top. The giants made it in the old days." And so the summons was issued. "Bring every man," the parchments instructed. "Bring every weapon, and say your prayers. For what is left of Wessex will meet at Egbert's Stone to carry battle to the Danes." And no sooner was the summons sent than disaster struck. It came just a week before the feared was to gather. Hupper, Ealdorman of Thornseater, wrote that 40 Danish ships were off his coast, and that he dared not lead the feared away from their threat. Worse, because the Danes were so numerous, he had begged Harald of Devonshire to lend him men. That letter almost destroyed Alfred's spirits. He had clung to his dream of surprising Guthrum by raising an unexpectedly powerful army, but all his hopes were now shredding away. He had always been thin, but suddenly he looked haggard, and he spent hours in the church, wrestling with God, unable to understand why the Almighty had so suddenly turned against him. And 2 days after the news of the Danish fleet, Svein of the White Horse led 300 mounted men in a raid against the hills on the edge of the swamp, and because scores of men from the Somerset feared had gathered in Æthelingaeg, Svein discovered and stole their horses. We had neither the room nor the forage to keep many horses in Æthelingaeg itself, and so they were pastured beyond the causeway. And I watched from the fort as Svein, riding a white horse and wearing his white-plumed helmet and white cloak, rounded up the beasts and drove them away. There was nothing I could do to stop him. I had 20 men in the fort, and Svein was leading hundreds.
"Why were the horses not guarded?"
Alfred wanted to know.
"They were,"
Wiglaf, Ealdorman of Somerset, said,
"and the guards died."
He saw Alfred's anger, but not his despair.
We haven't seen a Dane here for weeks, he pleaded. How were we to know they'd come in force? How many men died? Only 12.
Only? Alfred asked, wincing.
And how many horses lost?
63.
On the night before Ascension Day, Alfred walked beside the river. Bjorka, faithful as a hound, followed him at a distance, wanting to offer the king God's reassurance. But instead Alfred called to me. There was a moon, and its light shadowed his cheeks and made his pale eyes look almost white.
How many men will we have?
He asked abruptly. I did not need to think about the answer. 2,000. He nodded. He knew that number as well as I did. Maybe a few more, I suggested. He grunted at that. We would lead 350 men from Ethelingaeg, and Wiglaf, Ealdorman of Somerset, had promised 1,000, though in truth I doubted if that many would come. The feared of Wiltonshire had been weakened by Wulfhere's defection, but the southern part of the shire should yield 500 men, and we could expect some from Hamptonshire. But beyond that, we would depend on whatever few men made it past the Danish garrisons that now ring the heartland of Wessex. If Devonshire and Thornsetia had sent their feards, then we would have numbered close to 4,000. But they were not coming.
And Guthrum?
Alfred asked.
How many will he have?
4,000.
More like 5,
Alfred said. He stared at the river that was running low between the muddy banks. The water rippled about the wicker fish traps.
So should we fight?
What choice do we have? He smiled at that.
We have a choice, Uhtred,
he assured me.
We can run away. We can go to Francia. I could become a king in exile and pray that God brings me back.
You think God will?
No,
he admitted. If he ran away, then he knew he would die in exile. So we fight, I said.
And on my conscience,
he said,
I will forever bear the weight of all those men who died in a hopeless cause. 2,000 against 5,000? How can I justify leading so few against so many?
You know how.
So I can be king?
So that we are not slaves in our own land, I said. He pondered that for a while. An owl flew low overhead, a sudden surprise of white feathers and the rush of air across stubby wings. It was an omen, I knew, but of what kind?
Perhaps we are being punished,
Alfred said. For what?
For taking the land from the Britons.
That seemed nonsense to me. If Alfred's god wanted to punish him for his ancestors having taken the land from the Britons, then why send the Danes? Why not send the Britons?
God could resurrect Arthur and let his people have their revenge, but why send a new people to take the land?
Do you want Wessex or not? I asked harshly.
He said nothing for a while, then gave a sad smile.
In my conscience, he said, I can find no hope for this fight. But as a Christian, I must believe we can win it. God will not let us lose.
Nor will this, I said, and I slapped Serpent Breath's hilt.
So simple,
he asked.
Life is simple, I said. Ale, women, sword and reputation. Nothing else matters.
He shook his head, and I knew he was thinking about God and prayer and duty. But he did not argue.
So if you were I, Uhtred,
he said,
would you march?
You've already made up your mind, Lord, I said. So why ask me? He nodded. A dog barked in the village, and he turned to stare at the cottages and the hall and the church he had made with its tall alder cross.
Tomorrow,
he said,
You will take 100 horsemen and patrol ahead of the army.
Yes, lord.
And when we meet the enemy,
he went on, still staring at the cross,
you will choose 50 or 60 men from the bodyguard, the best you can find. And you will guard my banners.
He did not say more, but nor did he need to. What he meant was that I was to take the best warriors, the most savage men, the dangerous warriors who loved battle, and I was to lead them in the place where the fight would be hardest, for an enemy loves to capture his foe's banners. It was an honour to be asked, and, if the battle was lost, an almost certain death sentence.
"I shall do it gladly, lord," I said. "But ask a favour of you in return."
"If I can," he said guardedly.
"If you can," I said, "don't bury me. Burn my body on a pyre, and put a sword in my hand."
He hesitated, then nodded, knowing he had agreed to a pagan funeral.
"I never told you," he said, "that I am sorry about your son."
"So am I, lord."
"But he is with God, Uhtred. He is assuredly with God."
"So I'm told, lord. So I'm told."
And the next day we marched. Fate is inexorable. And though numbers and reason told us we could not win, we dared not lose. And so we marched to Egbert's Stone. We marched with ceremony. 23 priests and 18 monks formed our vanguard and chanted a psalm as they led Alfred's forces away from the fort guarding the southern trackway and east towards the heartland of Wessex. They chanted in Latin, so the words meant nothing to me, but Father Peerlig had been given use of one of Alfred's horses, and, dressed in a leather coat, and with a great sword strapped to his side, and with a stout shafted boar spear on one shoulder, he rode alongside me and translated the words.
"God," he said, "you have abandoned me. You have scattered us. You are angry with us. Now turn to us again."
"That sounds like a reasonable request, doesn't it? You've kicked us in the face, so now give us a cuddle, eh?"
"Well, it really means that."
"Not the bit about kicks and cuddles. That was for me." He grinned at me.
"I do miss war. Isn't that a sin?"
"You've seen war."
"Seen it. I was a warrior before I joined the church. Peerlig the Fearless, they called me. I killed 4 Saxons in a day once, all by myself, and I had nothing but a spear. And they had swords and shields, they did. Back home, they made a song about me. But mind you, the Britons will sing about anything. I can sing you the song if you like. It tells how I slaughtered 394 Saxons in one day. But it's not entirely accurate."
"So how many did you kill?"
"I told you, 4.
He laughed.
"So how did you learn English?"
"My mother was a Saxon, poor thing. She was taken in a raid on Mercia and became a slave."
"So why did you stop being a warrior?"
"Because I found God, Uhtred. Or God found me. And I was becoming too proud. Songs about yourself go to your head. And I was wickedly proud of myself, and pride is a terrible thing."
"It's a warrior's weapon," I said.
"It is indeed,"
he agreed.
"And that is why it is a terrible thing, and why I pray God purges me of it."
We were well ahead of the priests now, climbing towards the nearest hilltop to look north and east for the enemy, but the churchmen's voices followed us, their chants strong in the morning air.
"Through God we shall do bravely,"
Father Peerlig interpreted for me.
"And God shall trample down our enemies."
"Now there's a blessed thought for a fine morning, Lord Uhtred."
"The Danes are saying their own prayers, Father."
"But to what God, eh? No point in shouting at a deaf man, is there?"
He curbed his horse at the hilltop and stared northwards.
"Not even a mouse stirring."
"The Danes are watching," I said. "We can't see them, but they can see us." If they were watching, then what they could see was Alfred's 350 men riding or walking away from the swamp. And in the distance, another 500 or 600 men who were the feared from the western part of Somerset, who had camped to the south of the swamp, and now marched to join our smaller column. Most of the men from Ethelingage were real soldiers, trained to stand in the shield wall. But we also had 50 of the marshmen. I had wanted Eofor, the strong bowman, to come with us, but he could not fight without his niece telling him what to do, and I had no intention of taking a child to war, and so we had left Eofor behind. A good number of women and children were following the column, though Alfred had sent Aelswith and his children south to Shireburnen under a guard of 40 men. We could hardly spare those men, but Alfred insisted his family go. Aelswith was to wait in Shireburnen, and, if news came that her husband was defeated and the Danes victorious, she was to flee south to the coast and find a ship that would take her to Francia. She was also instructed to take with her whatever books she could find in Shireburnen, for Alfred reckoned the Danes would burn every book in Wessex, and so Aelswith was to rescue the gospel books and saints' lives, and church fathers and histories and philosophers, and thus raise her son Edward to become a learned king in exile. Isolt was with the army, walking with Hild and with Einflaed, who had upset Aelswith by insisting on following Leofric. The women led pack horses, which carried the army's shields, food, and spare spears. Nearly every woman was equipped with some kind of weapon. Even Hild, a nun, wanted to take revenge on the Danes who had whored her, and so carried a long, narrow-bladed knife.
"God help the Danes,"
Father Peerlig had said when he saw the women gather.
"If that lot get among them."
He and I now trotted eastwards. I had horsemen ringing the column, riding on every crest, staying in sight of each other, and ready to signal if they saw any sign of the enemy. But there was none. We rode or marched under a spring sky, through a land bright with flowers, and the priests and monks kept up their chanting, and sometimes the men behind, who followed Alfred's two standard-bearers, would start singing a battle song. Father Peerlig beat his hand in time to the singing, then gave me a big grin.
"I expect Isolt sings to you, doesn't she?"
"She does.
We Bretons love to sing. I must teach her some hymns."
He saw my sour look and laughed.
"Don't worry, Uhtred. She's no Christian."
"She isn't?" I asked, surprised.
"Well, she is, for the moment. I'm sorry you didn't come to a baptism. It was cold, that water. Fair froze me."
"She's baptized," I said. "But you say she's no Christian?"
"She is, and she isn't,"
Peerlig said with a grin.
"She is now, see, because she's among Christians. But she's still a Shadow Queen, and she won't forget it."
"You believe in Shadow Queens?"
"Of course I do. Good God, man, she is one."
He made the sign of the cross. "Brother Asa called her a witch," I said. "A sorceress."
"Well, he would, wouldn't he? He's a monk. Monks don't marry. He's terrified of women, Brother Asa, unless they're very ugly, and then he bullies them. But show him a pretty young thing, and he goes all addled. And of course he hates the power of women."
"Power?"
"Not just tits, I mean. God knows tits are powerful enough, but the real thing. Power. My mother had it. She was no Shadow Queen, mind you, but she was a healer and a scryer."
"She saw the future."
He shook his head. "She knew what was happening far off. When my father died, she suddenly screamed. Screamed fit to kill herself, because she knew what had happened. She was right, too. The poor man was cut down by a Saxon. But she was best as a healer. Folk came to her from miles around. Didn't matter that she was born a Saxon. They'd walk for a week to fetch the touch of her hand. Me, I got it for free. She banged me about, she did, and I dare say I deserved it, but she was a rare healer. And, of course, the priests don't like that."
"Why not?"
"Because we priests tell folk that all power comes from God,
and if it doesn't come from God, then it must be evil, see? So when folk are ill, the church wants them to pray and to give the priest money. Priests don't like it when they don't understand things. And they don't like folk going to the women to be healed. But what else are folk to do? My mother's hand, God rest her Saxon soul, was better than any prayer, better than the touch of the sacraments. I wouldn't stop folk going to see a healer. I'd tell them to. He stopped talking because I raised my hand. I'd seen movement on a hillside to the north, but it was only a deer. I dropped my hand and kicked the horse on. Now, your result, Peerlig went on. She's been raised with the power, and she won't lose it.
Didn't the baptism wash it out of her?
Not at all. It just made her a bit colder and cleaner. Nothing wrong with a scrub once or twice a year. He laughed. But she was frightened back there in the swamp. You were gone, and all around were Saxons, and they were spitting that she was a pagan. So what did you think she would do?
She wants to be one of them. She wants folk to stop spitting at her. So she said she'd be baptized.
And maybe she really is a Christian. I'd praise God for that mercy, but I'd rather praise him for making her happy.
You don't think she is?
Of course she isn't. She's in love with you.
He laughed.
And being in love with you means living among the Saxons, doesn't it? Poor girl. She's like a beautiful young hind that finds herself living among grunting pigs.
What a gift for words you have, I said.
He laughed, delighted with his insult.
Win your war, Lord Uhtred, he said. Then take her away from us priests and give her lots of children. She'll be happy, and one day she'll be truly wise. That's the women's real gift, to be wise, and not many men have it.
And my gift was to be a warrior, though there was no fighting that day. We saw no Danes, though I was certain they'd seen us, and that by now Guthrum would have been told that Alfred had at last come from the swamp and was marching inland. We were giving him the opportunity to destroy us, to finish Wessex, and I knew that the Danes would be readying to march on us. We spent that night at an earthen fort, built by the old people, and next morning went north and east through a hungry land. I rode ahead, going into the hills to look for the enemy, but again the world seemed empty. Rooks flew, hares danced, and cuckoos called from the woods that were thick with bluebells, but there were no Danes. I rode along a high ridge, gazing northwards, and saw nothing. And when the sun was at its height, I turned east. There were 10 of us in my band, and our guide was a man from Wiltonshire who knew the country, and he led us towards the valley of the Willig, where Egbert's stone stands. A mile or so short of the valley we saw horsemen, but they were to the south of us, and we galloped across ungrazed pastureland to find it was Alfred, escorted by Leofric, 5 soldiers and 4 priests.
"Have you been to the stone?"
Alfred called out eagerly as we closed on him.
"No, Lord. Doubtless there are men there,"
he said, disappointed that I could not bring him news.
"I didn't see any Danes either, Lord."
"It'll take them 2 days to organize," he said dismissively. "But they'll come. They'll come. And we shall beat them."
He twisted in his saddle to look at Father Biocca, who was one of the priests.
"Are you sore, Father?" "Mightily sore, Lord." "You're no horseman, Biocca. No horseman. But it's not much, Father. Not much, Father, then you can rest."
Alfred was in feverish mood.
"Rest before we fight, eh? Rest and pray, Father, then pray and fight. Pray and fight."
He kicked his horse into a gallop, and we pounded after him, through a pink-blossomed orchard and up a slope, then across a long hilltop where the bones of dead cattle lay in the new grass. White mayflower edged the woods at the foot of the hill, and a hawk slanted away from us, sliding across the valley towards the charred remains of a barn.
"It's just across the crest, Lord,"
my guide shouted at me.
"What is?" "Deferial, Lord."
Deferial was the name of the settlement in the valley of the River Willig, where Egbert Stone waited, and Alfred now spurred his horse so that his blue cloak flapped behind him. We were all galloping, spread across the hilltop, racing to be the first over the crest to see the Saxon forces. Then Father Bjocke's horse stumbled. He was, as Alfred said, a bad horseman. But that was no surprise, for he was both lame and palsied. And when the horse tipped forward, Bjocke tumbled from the saddle. I saw him rolling in the grass and turned my horse back.
"I'm not hurt,"
he shouted at me.
"Not hurt. Not much. Go on, Uhtred, go on."
I caught his horse. Bjocke was on his feet now, limping as fast as he could to where Alfred and the other horsemen stood in a line, gazing into the valley beyond.
"We should have brought the banners,"
Bjocke said as I gave him his reins.
"The banners?" "So the feared knows their king has come,"
he said breathlessly.
"They should see his banners on the skyline, Uhtred, and know he has come. The cross and the dragon, eh? In hoc signo. Alfred will be the new Constantine, Uhtred, a warrior of the cross. In hoc signo, God be praised. God be praised. God indeed be mightily praised."
I had no idea what he meant, and nor did I care, for I had reached the hilltop and could stare down into the long, lovely valley of the Willig, which was empty. Not a man in sight. Just the river and the willows and the water meadows and the alders and a heron flying and the grass bending in the wind and the triple stone of Egbert on a slope above the Willig, where an army was supposed to gather. And there was not one man there, not one single man in sight. The valley was empty. The men we had brought from Ethlingeig straggled into the valley, and with them now was the feared of Somerset. Together they numbered just over 1,000 men, and about half were equipped to fight in the shield wall, while the rest were only good for shoving the front ranks forward, or for dealing with the enemy wounded, or, more likely, dying. I could not face Alfred's disappointment. He said nothing about it, but his thin face was pale and set hard as he busied himself, deciding where the 1,000 men should camp, and where our few horses should be pastured. I rode up a high hill that lay to the north of the encampment, taking a score of men, including Leofric, Stiappa, and Father Peelig. The hill was steep, though that had not stopped the old people from making one of their strange graves high on the slope. The grave was a long mound, and Peelig made a wide detour rather than ride past it.
"Full of dragons it is," he explained to me.
"You've seen a dragon?" I asked.
"Would I be alive if I had? No one sees a dragon and lives."
I turned in the saddle and stared at the mound. "I thought folk were buried there."
"They are, and their treasures. So the dragon guards the hoard. That's what dragons do. Bury gold and you hatch a dragon, see?"
The horses had a struggle to climb the steep slope, but at its summit we were rewarded by a stretch of firm turf that offered views far to the north. I had climbed the hill to watch for Danes. Alfred might believe that it would be 2 or 3 days before we saw them, but I expected their scouts to be close, and it was possible that a war band might try to harass the men camping by the Willig. Yet I saw no one. To the northeast were great downs, sheep hills, while straight ahead was the lower ground where the cloud shadows raced across fields and over blossoming Mayflower and darkened the bright green new leaves.
"So, what happens now?"
Leofric asked me.
"You tell me."
"1,000 men? We can't fight the Danes with 1,000 men." I said nothing. Far off on the northern horizon there were dark clouds.
"We can't even stay here," Leofric said. "So where do we go?"
"Back to the swamp,"
Father Peelig suggested. "The Danes will bring more ships," I said, "and eventually they'll capture the swamp. If they send 100 ships up the rivers, then the swamp is theirs."
"Go to Devonshire," Stiappa growled.
And the same thing would happen there, I thought. We'd be safe for a time in Devonshire's tangle of hills and woods, but the Danes would come, and there would be a succession of little fights, and bit by bit, Alfred would be bled to death. And once the Danes across the sea knew that Alfred was pinned into a corner of Wessex, they would bring more ships to take the good land that he could not hold. And that, I thought, was why he had been right to try and end the war in one blow, because he dared not let Wessex's weakness become known. Except we were weak. We were 1,000 men. We were pathetic. We were dreams fallen to earth. And suddenly I began to laugh.
"What is it?"
Leofric asked. "I was thinking that Alfred insisted I learn to read," I said. "And for what?" He smiled, remembering. It was one of Alfred's rules that every man who commanded sizable bodies of troops must be able to read, though it was a rule he had ignored when he made Leofric commander of his bodyguard. It seemed funny at that moment. All that effort so I could read his orders, and he'd never sent me one. Not one.
"Reading is useful," Peleg said.
"What for?" He thought about it. The wind gusted, flapping his hair and beard.
"You can read all those good stories in the Gospel book,"
he suggested brightly.
"And the saints' lives. How about those, eh? They're full of lovely things, they are. There was Saint Donwen. Beautiful woman she was, and she gave a lover a drink that turned him into ice."
"Why does she do that?" Leofric asked.
"Didn't want to marry him, see?"
Peleg said, trying to cheer us up. But no one wanted to hear more about the frigid Saint Donwen. So he turned and stared northwards.
"That's where they'll come from, is it?"
he asked. "Probably," I said. And then I saw them. Or thought I did. There was a movement on the far hills, something stirring in the cloud shadow, and I wished Isolde was on the hilltop, for she had remarkable eyesight. But she would have needed a horse to climb to that summit, and there were no horses to spare for women. The Danes had thousands of horses, all the beasts they'd captured from Alfred at Sippenham, and all the animals they had stolen across Wessex. And now I was watching a group of horsemen on that far hill. Scouts, probably, and they would have seen us. Then they were gone. It had been a glimpse, no more, and so far away that I could not be sure of what I'd seen. "Or perhaps they won't come at all," I went on. "Perhaps they'll march around us, capture Wintoncester and everywhere else."
"The bastards will come,"
Leofric said grimly. And I thought he was probably right. The Danes would know we were here. They would want to destroy us. And after that, all would be easy for them. Peleg turned his horse as if to ride back down to the valley, then paused.
"So, it's hopeless, is it?"
he asked. "They'll outnumber us 4 or 5 to 1, I said.
"Then we must fight harder."
I smiled. "Every Dane who comes to Britain, father," I explained, "is a warrior. The farmers stay in Denmark, but the wild men come here. And us, we're nearly all farmers, and it takes 3 or 4 farmers to beat down a warrior."
"You're a warrior,"
he said.
"All of you. You're warriors. You all know how to fight. You can inspire men and lead men and kill your enemies. And God is on your side. With God on your side, who can beat you, eh? You want a sign?"
"Give me a sign," I said.
"Then look,"
he said, and pointed down to the willig. And I turned my horse, and there, in the afternoon sun, was the miracle we had wanted. Men were coming. Men in their hundreds. Men from the east and men from the south, men streaming down from the hills, men of the West Saxon feared, coming at their king's command to save their country.
"Now it's only 2 farmers to 1 warrior,"
Peleg said cheerfully.
"Up to our assholes," Leofric said.
But we were not alone any longer. The feared was gathering.
Part 3. The Feared. Chapter 12.
Most men came in large groups, led by their thanes, while others arrived in small bands, but together they swelled into an army. Arnulf, Ealdorman of Suthsiaxter, brought close to 400 men, and apologized that it could not be more. But there were Danish ships off his coast, and he had been forced to leave some of his feared to guard the shore. The men of Wiltonshire had been summoned by Wulfhere to join Guthrum's army, but the Reeve, a grim man named Osric, had scoured the southern part of the shire, and over 800 men had ignored their ealdorman's summons and came to Alfred instead. More arrived from the distant parts of Somerset to join Wiglaf's feared, that now numbered 1,000 men, while half that many came from Hamptonshire, including Burg Weird's garrison, in which were Edric and Kenwulf, crewmen from the Engle, and both embraced me. And with them was Father Willibald, eager and nervous. Almost every man came on foot, weary and hungry, with their boots falling apart. But they had swords and axes and spears and shields, and by mid-afternoon there were close to 3,000 men in the Willig Valley, and more were still coming as I rode towards the distant hill, where I thought I had seen the Danish scouts. Alfred sent me, and at the last moment Father Peerlig had offered to accompany me, and Alfred had looked surprised, appeared to think about it for a heartbeat, then nodded assent.
"Bring Uhtred home safe, father,"
he had said stiffly. I said nothing as we rode through the growing camp, but once we were on our own, I gave Peerlig a sour look. "That was all arranged," I said.
"What was?"
"You come in with me. He had your horse already saddled.
So what does Alfred want?"
Peerlig grinned.
"He wants me to talk you into becoming a Christian, of course. The king has great faith in my powers of speech."
"I am a Christian," I said.
"Are you now?
I was baptized, wasn't I? Twice, as it happens."
"Twice? Doubly holy, eh? How come you got it twice?"
"Because my name was changed when I was a child, and my stepmother thought heaven wouldn't recognize me under my old name." He laughed.
"So they washed the devil out of you the first time and slopped him back in the second?"
I said nothing to that, and Peerlig rode in silence for a time.
"Alfred wants me to make you a good Christian," he said after a while, "because he wants God's blessing."
"He thinks God will curse us because I'm fighting for him." Peerlig shook his head.
"He knows, Uhtred, that the enemy are pagans. If they win, then Christ is defeated. This isn't just a war over land. It's a war about God. And Alfred, poor man, is Christ's servant, so he will do all he can for his master, and that means trying to turn you into a pious example of Christian humility. If he can get you onto your knees, then it'll be easy to make the Danes grovel."
I laughed, as he had meant me to. "Well, if it encourages Alfred," I said, "tell him I'm a good Christian."
"I plan to tell him that anyway," Peerlig said, "just to cheer him up. But in truth, I wanted to come with you."
"Why?"
"Because I miss this life. God, I miss it. I loved being a warrior. All that irresponsibility, I relished it. Kill and make widows, frighten children. I was good at it, and I miss it. And I was always good at scouting. We'd see you Saxons blundering away like swine, and you never knew we were watching you. But don't worry, I'm not going to talk Christ into you, whatever the king wants."
Our job was to find the Danes if they were near. Alfred had marched to the Willig Valley to block any advance Guthrum made into the heartland of Wessex, but he still feared that the Danes might resist the lure of destroying his small army, and instead march around us to take southern Wessex, which would leave us stranded and surrounded by Danish garrisons.
That uncertainty meant Alfred was desperate for news of the enemy. So Peerlig and I rode north and east up the valley, until we came to where a smaller river flowed south into the Willig, and we followed that lesser stream past a large village that had been reduced to ashes. The small river passed through good farmland, but there were no cattle, no sheep, and the fields were unploughed and thick with weeds. We went slowly, for the horses were tired, and we were well north of our army now. The sun was low in the west, though it was early May, so the days were lengthening. There were mayfly on the river, and trout rising to them. And then a scuffling sound made us both pause, but it was only a pair of otter cubs scrabbling down to the water through the roots of a willow. Doves were nesting in the blackthorn, and warblers called from the riverbank, and somewhere a woodpecker drummed intermittently. We rode in silence for a while, turning away from the river to go into an orchard, where wrynecks sang among the pink blossom. Peerlig curved his horse under the trees and pointed at a muddy patch in the grass, and I saw hoofprints sifted with fallen petals. The prints were fresh, and there were a lot of them.
"Bastards were here, weren't they?" he said, "and not so long ago."
I looked up the valley. There was no one in sight. The hills rose steeply on either side, with thick woods on their lower slopes. I had the sudden uncomfortable feeling that we were being watched, that we were blundering, and the wolves were close.
"If I were a Dane," Peerlig spoke softly, and I suspected he shared my discomfort, "I'd be over there."
He jerked his head to the western trees.
"Why?"
"Because when you saw them, they saw us, and that's the way to where they saw us. Does that make sense?" He laughed wryly.
"I don't know, Uhtred. I just think the bastards are over there."
So we went east. We rode slowly, as if we did not have a care in the world, but once we were in the woods, we turned north. We both searched the ground for more hoofprints, but saw none, and the feeling of being watched had gone now, though we did wait for a long time to see if anyone was following us. There was only the wind in the trees. Yeah, I knew the Danes were near, just as a hall's hounds know when there are wolves in the nearby darkness. The hair on their neck stands up, they bare their teeth, they quiver. We came to a place where the trees ended, and we dismounted, tied the horses, and went to the wood's edge and just watched. And at last, we saw them. 30 to 40 Danes were on the valley's farther side, above the woods, and they had plainly ridden to the top of the hills, looked southwards, and were now coming back. They were scattered in a long line that was riding down into the woods.
"Scouting party?" Peerlig said.
"Well, they can't have seen much from that hilltop.
They saw us," he said.
"I think so."
"But they didn't attack us."
He was puzzled.
"Why not?"
"Look at me," I said.
"I get a treat every day."
"They thought I was a Dane," I said. I was not in mail and had no helmet, so my long hair fell free down my leather-clad back, and my arms were bright with rings. "And they probably thought you were my performing bear," I added. He laughed.
"So, shall we follow them?"
The only risk was crossing the valley, but if the enemy saw us, they would probably still assume I was a fellow Dane. So we cantered over the open ground, then rode up into the further woods. We heard the Danes before we saw them. They were careless, talking and laughing, unaware that any Saxons were close. Peerlig tucked his crucifix beneath his leather coat. Then we waited until we were sure the last of the Danes had passed, before kicking the horses uphill to find their tracks and so follow them. The shadows were lengthening, and that made me think that the Danish army must be close, for the scouting party would want to reach safety before dark. But as the hilly country flattened,
We saw that they had no intention of joining Guthrum's forces that evening. The patrolling Danes had their own camp, and as we approached it, we were nearly caught by another group of mounted scouts who rode in from the east. We heard the newcomers and swerved aside into a thicket, and watched a dozen men ride by. And then we dismounted and crept through the trees to see how many enemy were in the camp. There were perhaps 150 Danes in a small pasture. The first fires were being lit, suggesting they planned to spend the night where they were.
"All scouting parties," Peerling suggested.
"Confident bastards," I said. These men had been sent ahead to explore the hills, and they felt safe to camp in the open countryside, sure that no Saxon would attack them. And they were right. The West Saxon army was a long way south, and we had no warband in the area, and so the Danes would have a quiet night, and in the morning their scouts would ride again to watch Alfred's movements.
"But if they're here," Peerling suggested, "then it means Guthrum is following them."
"Maybe," I said. "Or perhaps Guthrum was marching well to the east or west, and had sent these men to make sure that Alfred was ignorant of his movements."
"We should go back," Peerling said. "Be dark soon."
But I had heard voices, and I held up a hand to silence him, and then went to my right, keeping to the places where the undergrowth was thickest, and heard what I thought I had heard. English. "They've got Saxons here," I said.
"Wulfhere's men."
Which made sense. We were in Wiltonshire, and Wulfhere's men would know this country, and who better to guide the Danes as they watched Alfred? The Saxons were coming into the wood, and we stayed behind some hawthorn bushes until we heard the sound of axes. They were cutting firewood. There seemed to be about a dozen of them. Most of the men who followed Wulfhere would probably be reluctant to fight Alfred, but some would have embraced their ealdorman's new cause, and doubtless those were the men who had been dispatched to guide the Danish scouting parties. Wulfhere would only have sent men he could trust, fearing that less loyal men would desert to Alfred, or just run away. So these Saxons were probably from the ealdorman's household troops. The warriors, who would profit most from being on the winner's side in the war between the Danes and the West Saxons.
"We shall get back to Alfred before it's dark," Peerling whispered.
But just then a voice sounded close and petulant.
"I will go tomorrow,"
the voice said.
"You won't, Lord," a man answered. There was the sound of splashing, and I realized one of the two men had come to the bushes for a piss, and the other one had followed him.
"You'll go nowhere tomorrow," the second man went on. "You'll stay here."
"I just want to see them,"
the petulant voice pleaded.
"You'll see them soon enough, but not tomorrow. You'll stay here with the guards."
"You can't make me."
"I can do what I like with you, Lord. You might command here, but you take my orders all the same."
The man's voice was hard and deep.
"And my orders are that you're staying here."
"I'll go if I want,"
the first voice insisted weakly, and was ignored. Very slowly, so that the blade made no noise against the scabbard's throat, I drew serpent breath. Peerling watched me, puzzled.
"Walk away," I whispered to him, "and make some noise."
He frowned in puzzlement at that, but I jerked my head and he trusted me. He stood and walked towards our horses, whistling softly, and immediately the two men followed. The one with the deep voice led. He was an old warrior, scar-faced and bulky.
"You!"
he shouted.
"Stop!"
And just then I stepped out from behind the hawthorn and swung serpent breath once, and her blade cut under his beard and into his throat, and cut so deep that I felt her scrape against his spine, and the blood, sudden and bright in the spring dusk, sprayed across the leaf mould. The man went down like a felled ox. The second man, the petulant man, was following close behind, and he was too astonished and much too scared to run away, and so I seized his arm and pulled him down behind the bushes.
"You can't..."
he began,
and I placed the flat of Serpent Breath's bloody blade against his mouth so that he whimpered with terror.
"Not a sound," I said to him, "or you're dead."
Peely came back then, sword drawn.